We're delighted to have here today Governor Jeb Bush, who really needs no introduction, but he's going to get a short one anyhow. And we also have Rocky Rodriguez, who we can call her the general counsel closer. She closed out the Bush term as general counsel. Pertinent to the discussion here, I think she helped with at least 200 judicial appointments. Some of you are sitting out there, I'm sure. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the importance of judicial selection. This is probably good because it's literally been 25 years since we started this, from when you were elected in 99. So one of the things that people may not realize is one of the things that was key was changing the judicial nominating commissions. There's a short story about that. We had somebody who was a deputy solicitor general, Lou Huebner, who worked for the attorney general's office. I could not have actually told you whether he was a D or an R, but I could have told you that he actually understood interpreting statutes. And so we had an opening on the First District Court of Appeal, and I suggested to him that he might want to apply to put in for that. Said, there's no guarantees, but I'd like to see you do that. So he put in, shame on me. He did not get an interview. Now what you need to understand about Lou is, at that point he had almost 400 published opinions where he was counsel of record. How many of you out here, if you're a judge, you can't do this? How many of you that are not a judge have that? Very few of you. They explained in their wisdom that, well, he was a government attorney and they thought there were enough government attorneys, they didn't want to see any others up there. So he didn't even have the courtesy of an interview. Given that, we knew it was going to be extremely difficult to get good judges through the process. Good judges were always very important to the governor. He had a lot of other policies that he wanted to implement, but obviously if you don't have good judges, it's going to be difficult to do that. Some things have come to fruition. It took some time. The Florida Supreme Court finally shifted to conservative in 2019. So you started in 99, took about 20 years. But that 20 years wasn't wasted. It was building up the lower courts that was going there. One of the other things that the governor put a lot of effort into was school choice, to give everybody the opportunity to attend a school of their choice. And it took, again, it took almost 25 years, 24 years, but now in the state of Florida, we have scholarship programs. So without regard to income, without regard to anything else, you can actually apply, and as long as there's space available, you can take your child to one of 2,400 private schools. We've also got other school choice. So it's my delight to have Governor Jeb Bush here today. Rocky, it's also a delight to have you back up here. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to them for the discussion. Oh, one thing I have to say. We're going to try to do pictures afterward, two pictures. If you were appointed by Governor Bush to a judgeship, please come up. And if you worked in the Bush administration, please come up. Thank you very much.
I think that's ageism, by the way, if you do that.
Oh.
Thank you, Daniel. And as you may recall, Daniel was the general counsel of the Florida Department of Education when Governor Bush was in office. And prior to that, he was an assistant general counsel in the governor's legal office. So he's got a long history with the governor and part of the good fight. So let's pick up. You were elected. And first of all, thank you so much for making the trip from Miami, Governor. We really appreciate it. I think everybody here, if they don't already know you, they know of you, and are very inspired by what you've done to improve our courts and our state. And so let's go back to 1998. You were elected on your second try for the governor's office. You'd run previously in 1994 and lost a close election to Governor Childs. And a few weeks after your election, there was a vacancy about to be filled on the Florida Supreme Court. And I believe Bobby Martinez was one of your advisors at the time on the judiciary and setting up your legal office. And there was a question of whether the outgoing Governor Childs was going to appoint her or whether you as the incoming governor should appoint the new justice. So can you tell us a little bit about what was happening and how it was that the two of you ended up doing a joint appointment of Justice Peggy Quince?
Thank you, Rocky. The reason I'm here is because it's payback time to Raquel Rodriguez, aka Rocky, who spent more than 4 years or close to 4 years, more than 4.4 years, working for me and keeping me out of trouble. The press secretary in my office learned how to say what the governor meant to say was, and then clean up after me. And what Rocky learned to do was to clean up after me, and something even more important, which was the legal messes that I created by my policy and by my words. So whenever she asks me to do anything for the rest of my life and her life, I'll be there to say thank you. So that's why I'm here.
Thank you.
So when I got elected, you know, I had five-point plans to do a bunch of stuff. This was in the era politically, it's going to sound like ancient history, where you actually had plans and you laid them out and you said what you're going to do. And, you had a whole, theoretically, the theory what behind this was, for those that have never seen this, that if you said what you're going to do, you had a chance to actually do it. And so I was all excited about our agenda. And then, you know, what happens is stuff happens. Including the chance to make a Supreme Court pick before you're even governor, or depending on this circumstance, and just, I don't know if it's ever been resolved, because I've learned to move on. Once you've finished serving, it's time to find new things to focus on. So I don't know if this dilemma ever was finished, which is it the incoming or outgoing governor that gets to make an appointment that is due on the election day? Or on inauguration day. I still have no clue. I don't think Governor Child's office had a clue either. We both made efforts to suggest it was, of course, it was the incoming in our case, and he said the outgoing. And so I don't remember. I think it was probably Linda Shelley and Sally Bradshaw probably said, let's stop this shit and just split the difference.
Chiefs of staff, respective governors.
Prospective chief of staff in my case. And so we... So I had my first chance to interview judges before the appointment. These were all high caliber people, but they really, none of them had the judicial philosophy that, as I understood it at least, that would be important, you know, for selecting a Supreme Court justice. And so it was kind of a random thing. I mean, I thought Justice Quince, and I was probably wrong about this, because of her experience as a prosecutor, particularly in capital cases, would be someone who would be, you know, a fierce supporter of our criminal justice system. I don't even know if she was or wasn't, but that clearly wasn't as relevant in the Supreme Court based on what I had to deal with once they, once I became governor. A lot of other issues came to play, and she was aligned with the Pariente, not just wing, I mean, it was... near total global domination for a while. So, but we made the choice jointly in order to not have a food fight at the very beginning. Just to remind everybody, this was the first time in Florida's history a Republican governor, not only a Republican governor, but a conservative, bilingual, crazy guy from Miami with libertarian instincts was working in concert with a Republican legislature. Never happened before. And so I was really focused on making sure that we didn't have all the controversies that happen all the time when you start out, to stay focused on the agenda that I laid out in my campaign, and that's what we tried to do.
Yeah, so some had advocated that there might be litigation over that, but you went in a different direction because you didn't want to distract from your priorities.
Yeah, exactly. Wanted to move on to get to the A-plus plan, the creation of a much more compassionate child welfare system, funding the programs that were, you guys will appreciate this. My first week in office in January of 1999, I'm summoned to Judge Wilkerson, I think his name Wilkinson or Wilkerson's, the building's named after him, apparently he's a prominent federal judge, in Miami, to explain why he shouldn't take over the program for the developmentally disabled in the state. Okay, I'm like, I'm not a lawyer. I had my agenda. I knew my stuff pretty good. I spent hours on the budget. I knew probably more about the budget than most governors did. I'm kind of nerdy about that stuff, but I didn't, the thought bubble, I'm in this federal court, and I'm thinking, what the hell? What, like, can a federal judge take over a state program? I was kind of like offended by that. Apparently they can. And so I started to realize how important the judiciary was, is my point, because almost every week there was some other interface with the federal courts or the state courts, and I learned to appreciate the process of selecting judges because it does have a huge long-term impact for sure. And I'm proud of the fact that we set up a system that I thought yielded pretty good results for the state.
It absolutely did. So one of the big reforms that came out of your initiatives was death penalty reform in 2000. Can you just tell us briefly what that was about? And then, you know, we had a bad outcome at the Supreme Court subsequently.
We had an outcome of the Supreme Court, to get to the end of the story, that they ignored the legislature, totally ignored them, just said, go away, little children. This is not your purview. You can't create through legislation. You can't invade the judiciary. And so, I mean, for those that are aware of the death penalty process, it is beyond justice delayed. It is justice denied. And as governor, I had a chance to, I think right off the bat, there was a case, a guy named, his nickname was Tiny Davis because he was 330 pounds, who brutally killed a pregnant mom and two infants in Jacksonville. He was a neighbor and just obliterated them in the most grotesque way, probably in the early 1990s or late 1980s, as I recall. I met the husband, father, and he spoke quite eloquently of the need to, the system was so broken, and how many times can you imagine where there would be an appeal, and he'd have to be there, and he would listen to this and relive this tragedy over and over again. I met many families like this, and so we tried to reform the system. We couldn't reform the federal part of it, which is just as horrendous in terms of the appeals. When it goes to the federal system, it is delayed beyond belief, no accountability. It's designed to kill the death penalty rather than have the legislature decide that that's the policy of the state. I would respect that, but the courts were legislating this by their inaction. So we went to the legislature. It was chaotic beyond belief because it's complicated. Thankfully, Tony Jennings it got really, I don't know if you know, sometimes the legislature loses control of their own process. Seemed like that happened this week, actually. And so she pulled, you know, she's an incredible leader. She pulled it out of the jaws of defeat. And we passed what would be, you know, putting real time constraints on the appeal process so as to think maybe you could get this done in 5 years, which should be done, you know, even less so. I mean, people have the right to make sure that their cases are appealed and that there's a review of all this. I totally get that. But for it to go on 25 years, I think is just horrific. And so, you know, we passed it. It was difficult. We got it done. And then the court, like the next day, said, it's not your business. Another reason why selections of judges is kind of important, because one case after another, and I'm sure we'll get to the 2000 election, everybody thinks about that a lot. Our court in the early 2000s, the Supreme Court, and most of the judiciary was activist, liberal, legislating, and basically not just all that, but also very monolithic. And maybe this is a bias of not being part of this kind of cabal that exists. And I'm not a, please don't take offense if you went to the University of Florida, phenomenal school. Don't take offense if you're in Blue Key. Phenomenal organization. And don't take offense if you're a moderate liberal white guy, because they basically ran the state for like 30, 40, 50 years until the new guys came in. And the judiciary was run similarly with this kind of mindset that there was very little diversity of thought and very little diversity of life experience as well. And so we made an effort to try to have people that were selected as judges that reflected the incredible, wonderful nature of our state, which is very diverse in many ways, and have front and center an ideology that was, where the judiciary wasn't an equal partner in the most aggressive one, but had more humility.
So it's interesting about how the court chose to rely on separation of powers in the death penalty reform case, because just a few months later, in the 2000, in the cases that led up to Bush v. Gore, the court decided to meddle in the statutory deadlines for returning the ballots to the Secretary of State, and then ordered a statewide recount, selective recount.
Selective. They selected four counties for the most, you know, four counties that had a higher chance of finding, mining votes for the guy that I didn't support. So not only did they, I mean, they didn't show consistency, is your point. It's, it did reek with a little bit of irony. I haven't thought about that in a long while, but now part of the problem was the law was, I guess the law was the, you know, was properly passed, but the lack of it was all in every state had a similar kind of deal. There was a belief that local governments, local entities were in charge of the election, and the standards should be local as well. And so they tried to impose their views on this, and it didn't mirror the legislation at all. It created chaos, and it created the Supreme Court's, the U.S. Supreme Court's involvement, which to this day they're getting, you know, they continue to be criticized for their involvement. It's not their fault that they were involved. It's the Florida Supreme Court, by their actions, that created the necessity, or we would have had a constitutional crisis of epic proportions.
The Florida ballots might not have been counted.
No, they wouldn't have been.
The vote would not have been counted in that election.
No, they wouldn't have been.
So 2000.
What a mess.
It was one of the greatest legal experiences of my life, though. That was.
Can I tell a quick story? Because I was governor before there was social media. I mean, like Wikipedia might not even existed. But now it exists. I don't know if you follow this stuff, but it's pretty powerful. So on December 12th, my wife's from Mexico, on December 12th, it is the celebration of the Virgen de Guadalupe. It is like the most important, iconic part. It's in the DNA of Mexico, its history, its past, its culture. And 2 million people during that week have a pilgrimage to the church that was built where the apparition of Christ was shown on a shawl of a peasant in 15th, 16th century Mexico. So my wife and I actually was in Washington in the morning, or on the 11th, to sign the Everglades, or to participate in this federal component, the match program for the restoration of the Everglades. So I'm in there, I'm in the Oval with Bill Clinton, Al Gore wasn't there. I go out, have a press conference. They don't really care about the restoration of the Everglades in the National Press Corps. I'm surprised, but they were more curious about our election. I'd rope-a-dope my way through that, came back, and I went with my wife, to a place that is west of Quincy, Florida, in literally the middle of nowhere, where they opened a Catholic a church. There were probably 300 people there, 299 Mexicans, and me, and we celebrated Mass there. This was a church that was set up principally, I guess, because of farm workers that were in this area. They were mushroom growers. And if you know anything about, I learned about this, it is an incredibly difficult job. These big warehouses where they grow mushrooms. And so these are devout Catholics. They celebrated Mass. On the way home, the Supreme Court ruled. And so, long story long, people today still think that I took my wife on December 12th to the cathedral, along with 2 million pilgrims to pray for my brother's victory in front of the Virgin. And I don't disagree with him anymore. I just say, yeah, that's what I did, and it worked.
I'm sure there were a lot of us praying for his victory. So in the next session in 2001, the reform of the JNCs comes about. Just by way of background, because I'm not sure if everyone is aware of how the JNCs were, members of the JNCs were chosen prior to then. It started with Governor Reuben Askew in the mid-70s.
Did Hawks have something to do with that?
He had to.
You did, didn't you, Paul?
Yes, you did.
Executive order, an advisory board of three people appointed by the governor, three people appointed by the Florida Bar, and those six together would appoint three others. And the governor could reject anybody, the nominees from that group. So that's what it was like under an executive order from Reuben Askew. And then in some years later, in the 90s, it was codified into law and by statute, and it was still the three, but now the governor had no ability to veto the judicial nominees. And at some point, at least three nominees or no more than six. And so that was, but it was still the 3-3-3 that had been set up by Governor Askew. And so effectively, the bar had almost complete control of how the JNCs operated. And we got those very liberal judges that the governor was talking about, as well as the blue key mindset, let's call it. No offense.
Ixnay the blue key thing, because it's a great organization, but you got my drift, I think.
So in 2001, we the reform came that we were discussing earlier, and that Daniel was describing. And so now the governor got to appoint all of the members of the JNC, and at least four of them were from slates nominated by the Florida Bar, but five, the majority, would be direct appointments from the governor. And the governor also had the ability to veto the bar's nominees. So that started at some in 2001. As you may know, many of you here are JNC members. It's staggered terms, so it took a long time for the process to work itself out, but you started doing it when the next set of vacancies came up. Tell us a little bit about how you looked at the judicial nominating commissions and your appointments of those citizens.
I grew to respect the importance of the Florida legislature, for sure. The longer I stayed, you know, my first year, it was like blowing through them, kind of, and they wanted to make sure the rookie governor was successful. And over time, I really realized the importance of being a partner with the legislature. And this was their doing. I mean, it was a great idea. They got it passed. And not only that, we needed more judges in the judiciary as well. And rather than have them be go through elections, they funded more slots and they allowed the governor to pick them. So all power, all praise goes to the legislature. All governors should be reminded that they are an equal branch of government. Might be a useful thing going forward.
I heard something about that this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's you can get frustrated because it's not a process that's as logical as we're normal. You know, normal people don't. It can be frustrating, but there should be a lot of respect to the process, and they get credit for this. Look, I probably could have thrown back more judges using the veto power.
Commissioners,
yeah. I could have done that probably a little more aggressively. I think we did it once or twice because it did take time for the process to work. But when it did, it started working quite well. And I think successive governors have really seen the caliber of judges improved dramatically by that reform. I was really pleased they did it. Paul, I thought you were involved in that. You're normally involved in the good stuff in the judiciary. That wasn't one of them, huh? It was. Okay, that's what I thought.
Well, he was a successful nominee.
Yes, he was.
You appointed him.
Yes, yeah. I did.
So you're getting nominees before and after the 2001 reform. Tell us what you were looking for in the judges, and in retrospect, were the criteria that you were looking for still the relevant criteria, or would you change anything?
No, I think, I mean, if the Federalist Society was as big as it is now, I probably just said, are you a member of the Federalist Society, and ask people in the Federalist Society if they're really Federalist Society members. it would have simplified the process. But there, look, I relied on you and others that were part of the process of interviewing to provide the legal framework. I asked a few questions, and I stopped. I would ask a question, what book are you reading? Because I asked that for everybody, not just the judiciary, because it's an example of curiosity. And I think being curious in life is really important in leadership positions. In positions of responsibility, humility and curiosity are like two ingredients that keep you grounded and keep you learning and allow you to listen to other people that may not agree with you. All this, you know, frou-frou stuff is actually pretty important. So I would ask questions like, what book are you reading? And it turns out everybody was reading Robert Bork's book. I don't know. I was like, really? Really? You're reading Robert Bork's book? So I stopped asking that question because it was, or if they did answer it in a complete fabricated fashion like that, you know, memo to myself, probably not going to be what he or she said she was going to do in the judiciary. But we asked the standard questions. The one question I thought was relevant is, give me an example of a Florida Supreme Court ruling, or U.S., but hopefully Florida Supreme Court ruling, where you agreed with the decision, but you disagreed with the policy. Does that make sense? Where you had a view in the political realm, but you knew that the judicial framework was the proper one to take. Because I think that's the ultimate test: is are you legislating as a politician, or are you looking at things from a judicial framework? And it was surprising how hard that was for some of the candidates. They couldn't think of one. And normally this stuff gets out, by the way. You know, the questions, the next group will know what the questions are going to be, and so they should be prepared for that. But it was really quite unsatisfactory, the responses that I generally got. And when it was when someone did have an answer, it was clear and it was concise, and they had clearly thought it through. So this is not a science, this is an art. But I relied on the really talented legal office that we had. The Bush legal alumni is pretty powerful because they were pretty powerful when I was governor.
And you taught us a lot in the process, I think. I remember that at some point it switched from Bork to Scalia's matter of interpretation. People would walk in with the book, right?
Can I tell a quick 2000 story, another legal one? So I come back from Austin. I'm like, holy shit, what the hell? Why me? What's going on here? It was pretty dramatic. And over time, it was pretty clear that there were ministerial duties that the governor had. And I wanted to make sure that whatever those were, that I followed them, in an unimpeachable way, that it was like done the right way. So I told Reg Brown and Frank Jimenez, my two deputy legal counsel, give me the two smartest conservative constitutional experts, invite them for a meeting for them to lay out the ministerial duties of in the process of the Electoral College and all aspects of the post-election work. And you know who came?
Who?
John Roberts, not as a judge, obviously, and John Yoo. It was like, wow, in retrospect, it was like pretty impressive choices. Mm-hmm. And they gave me the advice that was pretty clear, but at least I could say that I spoke to constitutional experts because no one was going to believe me being one. And it was a fascinating time to see how it worked. And this has obviously played out, time and time again, particularly in the 16 or the 20 election.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's... Very different approaches. The courts kind of flipped from the let's do recounts to no recounts, but I think it was consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Bush v. Gore.
Well, in Florida, the legislature responded to the mess that we had, with probably the model legislation for the rest of the country. So all that Florida dust stuff that just like drove me nuts, because I love Florida, and I think it's, and now it's been proven out, this place is just the best by far of any state. I'm totally biased, I admit it. I'm not objective about this, but.
Well.
But our law is, the election law works really well. And you can call the third largest state's election by 9 o'clock, no matter how close it is. And every state ought to model, that's, you know, the way it should work is whatever great idea exists in one state, other states should steal it if it's working and claim it as their own. And it's still, to this day, if Michigan or Pennsylvania had a close election, they'd be in a heap of trouble. I mean, in Wisconsin, they haven't figured out what they need to be doing. And the restoration of trust of our institutions is probably the greatest challenge, I think, for our democracy. And this would be a good thing to, you know, do what Florida does. No more Florida, duh. Do what we do, and you're going to be a lot better off.
As a side note, so you helped improve the process, got rid of the punch cards. No excuse. Absentee voting was added under you. Early voting was added under you, and you got rid of an absolute incompetent supervisor of elections in Broward County.
Yes, I did.
That was a huge improvement. So let's go back to...
Unfortunately, I appointed someone who got reelected and like two terms later mimicked the person that I fired.
Yeah, she started off okay.
She had a good 12-year run before she lost her way.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2001...
Isn't that where Pete Antonacci went?
God, Mr. Fix-It, may he rest in peace.
He rest in peace. What a guy.
Pete Antonacci. And then I think he fixed Palm Beach. Yeah. 2001, you have another Supreme Court vacancy. And because of your appointment of Justice Quince to fill the second DCA slot at the Florida Supreme Court, because you know you got to have at least 5 from the different DCAs, and then there's 2 at-large appointments. I don't know how the 6 DCA plays into this. Someone will tell me. You appoint Justice Raul Garcia Cantero, appellate lawyer extraordinaire from Miami-Dade County.
I did.
And...
the only mistake that I made about Raul, and this is a problem that's been resolved in a really dramatic way, was I thought, and I think everybody around me, no one told me, appoint old people. Appoint young people that will be there for a long, long while. It made sense to me at the time. The problem is the 2 people that I did appoint that were relatively young to the Supreme Court, had families, and they didn't want to live in Tallahassee. It's not the, if you're from Miami and your children are growing up, it's not an easy thing to do. Raul and Ken Bell both did phenomenal jobs, I think, as Supreme Court justices, but the theory of appointing younger people didn't quite work out, and that probably delayed the control of the Supreme Court.
So Justice Bell was appointed in December of 2002. That was, I think, my first day on the job, where the Florida Supreme Court interviews, where he eventually got appointed. And
but now you can live where you can, yep. serve from wherever you live, which we should have thought of that.
I think the Chief Justice could have done something about it, but did not, and that's resulted in
that. They have almighty power. They could have done it.
Yeah. So one thing you mentioned earlier with your judicial appointments, the importance of diversity of thought and other forms of diversity of experience. Today diversity is kind of a bad name in some circumstances, but you appointed a lot of very qualified people who also represented a lot of different parts of the state and the people here. I just want to recite a couple of the statistics. You had 343 appointments during your 8 years, and minorities on the bench, self-identified minorities, went from 85 to 144. Of that group, the black judges were increased from 46 to 66 statewide, and Hispanic judges were increased from 32 to 68, and women went up double what they used to be to 109. About a third of your appointments were women. And so tell us a little bit about how you viewed the importance of diversity in its many forms and how you believe it improved the courts.
Yeah, so diversity has gotten a massively bad name because it has been thrown into the context of oppressors and oppressed, in that depending on your birth or your circumstances, you're either one or the other. And that's not the diversity that we embraced. I really thought it was important, and again, no disrespect to the Blue Key University of Florida. This is really, I'm getting in serious trouble. I'm thinking of Karen Unger's going to call me up and start shouting profanities. But the state needed to change to represent, for people in leadership positions, I think, that had different backgrounds. I mean, just whether it was in our office or in the departments or in the judiciary, I thought that was an important thing. Not so, as it relates to ideology, I wanted people that shared my vision of the role of government, which was it should be limited, it should be reformed, it ought to be focused on outcomes, we should measure it. If it doesn't work, we should stop it and move on to other things. All that stuff that I truly believe is important and we had a chance to implement. People shared that vision, but they came from all sorts of backgrounds. And I think the judiciary is better off when you have a diversity of opinion. I also found that for the county courts, having some sense of who's in front of you is kind of important. And I learned this when I campaigned. I would sit in, I'm kind of a nerd, so I was curious about, like, juvenile justice, child welfare. You go sit with a judge for 3 or 4 hours in a courtroom or a county judge dealing with minor crimes, and you get a sense of the soft underbelly of your communities. You get a sense of how hard this job is, and having someone who adheres to the law but also has some understanding of the plight of people, I think, is kind of important. So all of that was put into the context of how we appointed judges. And I think I got an award from some women's group for the judicial appointments. It was kind of hilarious because this was like this group, I don't remember the name, but they were
an association of women lawyers, I think.
They were all liberal. That's all I remember.
There's a few conservative members of the group here, by
sure.
The way.
Well, this group that was giving me the award, I think they may have came. I don't remember if they came to gov. Whatever it was, I could tell. You can tell when people are not happy to be with you. you learn that. In my case, I learned it pretty often. And so they were not, but they, you know, they had to admit that we did this, but they were a little grumpy about it. And I'm happy that we did it. And I think, you know, whether you're a man or a woman or black or Hispanic, or you don't identify in any of that stuff, you identify yourself as an American, the talent that we had a chance to appoint, I think, is there for people to see. And I'm proud of it.
And just to give a complete picture of how you handled, I mean, you started the One Florida initiative, eliminating preferences in contracting and other things. And you also eliminated set-asides in the colleges and the universities.
And state government.
And state government. And merit-based everything, but still creating opportunity for everyone.
Yeah, so the executive order that I signed to this day still exists. It's probably the longest-serving executive order. People don't want to go back to the legislature, I guess, and change the law. But the executive order, if it was challenged, it was ruled kosher. So the idea was to say, look, we had a department inside the Department of a bureau inside the Department of Labor at the time that had, call it, 35, 40 people whose job it was to certify that a black person was a black person and a Hispanic person was Hispanic and a woman was a woman. I guess that's gotten more complicated in the world we're in now. Back then, it was not a complicated thing. It was pretty clear. There was no, like, we're living in really weird times, by the way, just for the record. any case, they were regulators, and they would spend a lot of money, and it was hard to be certified. And my attitude was, look, this guy's black. He's got a business. Why spend all this money? Help him identify opportunities to sell, but don't give him a 15% preferential price or don't create quotas. Let him compete, make sure, you know. So we turned that 35 people into, I think, call it 15 salespeople, whose job it was to identify opportunities for small businesses, small minority in minority businesses principally, and women-owned businesses. And we had three-digit increases in procurement of services and goods. Three digits. Now, how does that happen? I made it a priority. I actually measured it. And I would have cabinet meetings, and I would say, you know, Schmidlap, you're really sucking at this. You got, you know, no increase in you know, like, why is it? Why aren't you trying to figure out, give people, aspirational people, a chance to pull, you know, to push out the incumbents a little bit to have a more dynamic purchasing process? It worked. We had, and to this day, I don't know if anybody else, new, you know, old guy leaves, new guy comes in. I don't think anybody's created the same priority, but my guess is, as Florida's grown and changed, that women-owned businesses and minority-owned businesses are doing well with state government.
So we've only
university's the same thing. Yep. One of the things that I'm really proud of, when One Florida was initiated, back to the University of Florida, it was and to this day it's still probably a little too lily white, but part of that is the location. Gainesville's a tough place for people that live in the urban core areas of our state. It's expensive to get there. It's pretty tough. So Bernie Manchin came to me and said, I got an idea. Give us some funding, all state universities, first in generation folks, give them a chance, give them a scholarship to help with being able to come, you know, leave Miami or Fort Lauderdale to go up to Gainesville. And to this day, that is the single biggest driver of minority students at the University of Florida. And they're now obviously alumni, and they've given back disproportionately more. They're more engaged in the university, and the success is there for people to see. That, I don't know if that's race conscious or not, but it's certainly not race based. That is a far better way of dealing with people that have the same aspirations of those that are, you know, more prosperous perhaps, or have families that are more intact, whatever the social consequences are. It is a much better way of trying to deal with the issues that you want to make sure that we live in an opportunity society where everybody has a chance to rise up and succeed. And Florida is a model now for other states. And we were a little ahead of our time on the affirmative action thing. I mean, that's another 20-year story, right?
Yep. Two amicus briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court, authored by Daniel and myself, mostly Daniel and Nate, I think. So just to wrap up, we got a couple minutes only. Bush v. Shivo, your own appointees.
You're the one that's going to talk about this.
Well, I get too emotional. Justice Bell and Justice Quintero, who I still consider friends, voted with a unanimous Supreme Court to hold that the legislation that gave you the ability to direct the reinsertion of the feeding tube on Terri Schiavo violated separation of powers because the courts had already spoken that it had to be removed. Any thoughts on?
All I got is sad thoughts.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the idea that you have parents that love their child with their heart and soul. Again, this is not the law. I'm not a lawyer. That she would be allowed to starve to death. I mean, forced to starve to death with their parents right there, willing to not be wards of the state, not to have any state support. They would love their child. She's a child of God. And I just, you know, it was really hard for me to be comfortable with that. In fact, it was a miserable time. How long did it take for the starvation to take place after the court ruled? Like 10 days or something.
Yeah, like 7 to 10 days. Ultimately, the dehydration got her.
Close to the 10 most miserable days of my life as governor.
It was the low point of my career, for sure.
So, but the one thing that it became apparent is the Florida legislature should change that law to protect the rights of those that have no voice. That's the answer is the legislature could be clear about this. The law that existed is one of the most progressive is the opposite of what I want. I'm not sure that's the right definition. But the law here is very permissive for the state to come in and do what they did. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why that is, but there's precedent that was established, I think, in the 80s, perhaps, that never was changed. And I don't believe it's changed since then either.
No. So to end on a high note,
please.
I just want you to know that even though you only had, let's call it 2.5 state Supreme Court appointments, your influence has been felt on the state Supreme Court to this day. Two of our justices, Chief Justice Carlos Muñiz was your deputy general counsel for 2 years. Former Chief Justice Charles Kennedy was your general counsel for a year, and then you appointed him to the second DCA. He's my favorite judicial appointment because that made it possible for me to go work for Governor Bush. You appointed Ricky Polston to the first DCA, who's still on the court, right? No longer there, but he was on the court. Judge Alan Lawson, you had appointed to the second DCA. He was on the court for a while. And Judge Barbara Lagoa, who you appointed to the third DCA, who was on the state Supreme Court until President Trump recruited her away and appointed her to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. So it's too bad you didn't get all those appointments at the same time. That would have been a really amazing court with the Justice Bell and Justice Quintero, too. Seven.
Well, you got to share in the glory with Governors Scott and DeSantis. I think... You know, it did take a while. We went from probably top, you know, if you were a judicial activist, Florida was probably top two or three in the country in terms of judicial activism, that Supreme Court. Today, I would say that our Supreme Court is probably, of the state Supreme Courts, is probably the best. So it took a while, but we certainly got there. And the hits keep on coming. I mean, the selections, Governor DeSantis' selections to the courts have been phenomenal. Governor Scott's have been as well. I won't mention the one between.
Would have had a majority sooner.
Well, he was probably pretty good until he wasn't. So.
Med-Mal damages caps might still be there, but for that appointment.
Elections have consequences, I guess, and in the case of the state we love, these are really phenomenal consequences, that to have a consistent conservatives in the legislature and in the executive branch to make the judiciary a partner, an equal partner, but a humble one.
Governor, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope you'll come back whenever you like.